Okay, we have two sedras. There's a lot of topics. We'll try to cover some of them at least minimally. The sedra of Matos starts out with the laws of Nedarim. A person can make a nether to prohibit something on himself that the Torah normally says is mutter. A person decides he wants to create a new prohibition. Or he can make a nether to do something that he's not required to do, but he wants to do. Or there's also nidrei tzedakah, right? Person wants to give something to tzedakah, whatever. It's a different kind of nether. Nidorim to do with the Beis HaMikdash, to make a korban or whatever. That's a different kind of nether. And when it comes to the nidorim that a person makes to do things that he doesn't have to do, but he wants to now obligate himself with a vow to do something or to prohibit something on himself, which is normally okay, and he decides he wants to prohibit it. So on the one hand, Chazal look at that in a very negative way. And they say that it's better not to make nedarim, better not to make these kind of vows. It's not enough what the Torah prohibited. It's not enough what the Torah said you have to do. You have to make extra things, new things. And in one place, Chazal compare making a nether to building a bama. A bama is a private altar that a person would make that's prohibited. Right? You have to bring your sacrifices to the Beis HaMikdash. And a person builds a private altar in his backyard, it's a prohibited thing. And if he sacrifices on it, it's another prohibition. So the Gemara says that a person who makes a nether, that's not necessary. It's like he built a bama, he built his own little altar in his backyard, and if he fulfills the nether, it's like he made a sacrifice on it. Both things are prohibited. Both things are not for sure not positive things. On the other hand, we know that nedarim do serve a purpose, that sometimes a person should make a nether. So when is it, when is it not? Basically, the Mefarshim say like this. If a person has the desire to make something osur that what the Torah said was okay, right? Torah says you can eat bananas. I'm making a nether. I'm not allowed to eat bananas. So why would a person do that? So one motivation is ego, right? Want to make my own Torah. I'm not satisfied with God's Torah. Right? I have to have my things that I prohibited or I made a mitzvah. So I'm the source. And that is like building your own little personal altar and making your own personal sacrifice, which is not what is positive. So in general, if that's the motivation, it's not a positive thing. So when is it a positive thing? When a person knows his nature and he knows that if he just goes and toes the line of what the Torah prohibited or the Torah demanded you do, he's going to go over the line, right? An example. Person knows that he has this tremendous desire for meat, and he can't control it. And therefore, he ends up eating non-kosher meat constantly. So he makes a nether not to eat any meat. And this way, by not having the appetite to eat meat, he'll keep himself from eating treif. Okay, sometimes it's the opposite. If you totally prohibit yourself from it, you're going to have more of a chance of doing what's wrong than if you let yourself channel it into good areas. But it depends on the person. Some people function like this, some people like this. Person knows his nature. He knows that if he starts eating meat, fly off the handle and he's going to end up eating non-kosher stuff. So he makes a nether not to eat meat. Now, the Torah says you can't eat non-kosher meat. Why isn't that enough for him? His nether now, he has to keep, because the Torah said you have to keep a nether. Why is it going to be easier for him to enforce for himself his vow than to enforce for himself what the Torah said he can't eat? The answer is very simple. Because the Torah is God's telling you what to do. The nether is you telling you what to do. I am the source of this prohibition. So there's a certain amount of ego involved. So it's sometimes a lot easier for a person to do what he created than what God tells him to do. So therefore, in that situation, it's like the lesser of two evils. Right? It's not a great thing to create your own Torah. But where you're doing it in order to enforce God's Torah, and you know that's the only way for you, then it's a positive thing. Because in the end, the goal is a good goal. That's the idea. And therefore, once a year, even though it's not across the board and it doesn't apply to everything, but in principle, in general, we take away all Nidorim. When is that? Kol Nidre. Before Yom Kippur. Kol Nidre. Why? Because Yom Kippur, a person should go into without having to mix his ego into the Torah. It's necessary during the year to add to the Torah sometimes your own prohibitions or your own mitzvahs to safeguard the Torah. But on Yom Kippur, a person returns to his essence, to the source. He doesn't need those ego things to be able to have to do what the Rabban Shalom wants. He's able to go back to the source and do it because God wants to do it, for one day a year at least. So in that situation, we start Yom Kippur with Kol Nidre to show that we're going back to the essence of what we are. We don't need to add to that essence things that we build ourselves up, even if it's for a good purpose. But it's enough to do what the Rabban Shalom said we should do, and do it because he said it, not because I said it or I added to it or whatever. Yeah. No, because it doesn't apply to Ol Nedarim, and it doesn't help. It's more conceptual than actual. Halachically, it doesn't hold that much water, Kol Nidre. It's just more of a symbolic kind of thing, because it doesn't really have the... it's like Hataras Nedarim that we make. If it's, you know, a specific nether, you have to go to a chacham, you have to tell him what it is, you have to tell him that you regret it, why you regret it, and the regret has to be that if you would have known this, you never would have made the nether to begin with. There's a lot of laws. Here, we're just doing it for Nidorin that we don't really know about. We're not sure if we made them. Cases, anything like that, it's a blanket kind of thing. But it doesn't work for real specific Nidorin. For that, you have to go nether by nether, and there's a lot of things that you can't, what's it called, bimater, and some things you can, but they need different details or whatever. So it's more symbolic and like a safety net. That's all. Okay. In this parsha of Nedarim, the Torah says the following. Isha haferam, the Torah gave the power to a husband to nullify some of his wife's vows. The ones that affect him, they have two conditions. They're inui nefesh. There's something that is oppressive to the woman who made the nether. I'm not going to eat. I'm not going to put on makeup. Right? Something that's oppressive to her. She made a nether. And it's dvarim beino leveino. Things that affect the husband. Right? He doesn't want his wife not to put on makeup. He doesn't want a wife who's starving herself to death or whatever. So therefore, he has a right to be mefer the nether. If he hears the nether within that day, right, not 24 hours, the end of that day. If he hears the nether at the beginning of the night, he has 24 hours till sunset of the next day. If he hears it 5 minutes before sunset, he has till sunset to be mefer the nether. So if he says it's mufer, then that's it. Then there's no more nether. She doesn't have to hear him say it. She doesn't have to even know that he did it. But it's like he obliterates the nether. So, in the following scenario, a woman makes a nether, she's not going to eat cake. Okay, she wants to go on a diet, and she knows she can't stick to the diet unless she really makes it serious, so she makes a nether, I'm not going to eat cake. Her husband hears the nether, and he's not happy with it, right? He wants more of his wife, right? So he's happy that she eats a lot of cake. And he says the nether is mufer. That's it. No more nether. But he doesn't tell her. Now she thinks she has a nether. And she holds out for 2 weeks and doesn't eat a morsel of cake. And at the end of the 2 weeks she can't control herself. She swallows a chocolate cake whole. And she comes to her husband and she says, I feel terrible, physically and spiritually. I just swallowed a whole chocolate cake. And I made a neder 2 weeks ago that I wouldn't eat cake. So I just have transgressed my neder. The husband says, don't worry. I was made for the neder. When I heard it, I obliterated it. So you never had a neder. So you didn't do anything wrong. So the Torah says, Isha haferam, even though her husband obliterated the neder, v'Hashem yislach lo, she has to get forgiveness from God. What did we learn from that? That if somebody intended to eat treif, by accident they ate kosher, they still need kapara. Even though they ate something treif, they ate something kosher, but they thought it was treif, you need kapara for the bad thought. Now, first of all, you have to understand, why is that different than the rule of machshava tova in a kodesh baruch hu mitzar for lemaisa? If you have a bad intention, but you don't actually bring it to fruition, you don't need any atonement. Okay, you don't need to atone for that. Example, I'll give you two examples, we'll see the difference of the two cases. Person walks into a non-kosher restaurant, let's not make it in Israel, let's make it to somewhere in New York. What? He goes into a non-kosher restaurant, and he says, you know, I'm tired of eating kosher food. It has no taste. I want a real non-kosher steak, something that'll taste good. And he orders a non-kosher steak, and the waiter is bringing it from the kitchen, and all of a sudden a lightning bolt hits the waiter, the steak, the whole restaurant goes up in flames. The only thing left, everything is smoldering around him except for this guy and his table. The only thing left, he's not going to get his steak. So that's it. Goes home without the steak. Now, he didn't change his mind. If they would have delivered the steak, he would have eaten it. But he didn't get it. So what does he have? Bad intention. God does not count that as if he did anything. He doesn't have to do any tshuva. He doesn't have to come Yom Kippur and clap al chait for ordering the steak. In the end, he didn't eat it, even though it was beyond his control. It wasn't because of his choice he didn't eat it. It was because of circumstances. He doesn't need to be atoned for. On the other hand, walks into that restaurant, new situation. And he doesn't know that the kitchen of the restaurant was burnt down the night before. They can't prepare any food. But they didn't want to close the restaurant because they'd lose customers. So they made a deal with the Glatt Kosher restaurant down the block that they would supply all the food that anybody ordered and bring it into the back door through the kitchen. And they think that they're serving their food when in fact they're being supplied by the Glatt Kosher restaurant down the block. So the guy comes into the restaurant, he says, I'm sick and tired of this kosher food, I want to eat something treif. He orders this treif steak, and the waiter goes into the kitchen, gets on the phone, calls the Glatt Kosher restaurant down the block, send me over a steak fast. Send over a steak and disposable things. He apologizes, we have a problem with our kitchen, we don't have cutlery or whatever, everything has to be plastic, but here's your steak. Guy sits there, eats a steak. Ah, now this is a steak. Not like the Glatt Kosher place on the block. This tastes like a steak. But he's eating a Glatt Kosher steak, but he doesn't know it. When he finds out that he didn't eat a treif steak, he ate a kosher steak, he needs kapara. That's what we learn from this pasuk. If you intended to eat treif, but by accident you ate kosher, you still need kapara. Now what's the difference? In both cases, the only thing wrong was the thought. In the first case, you don't need atonement for the thought. Right, the plan to eat it. And here, you do need atonement. So what are you going to tell me? Well, he ate something, but you ate kosher. It's only the thought in your mind that's no good. So what's the difference? If you don't get punished, you don't need atonement for thoughts. Here there's only a thought, there's only a thought. That thought you don't need atonement for, here you do. The answer is that rule that you don't need atonement for bad intentions only applies where God can give you the benefit of the doubt that you wouldn't have carried through your intention.
Or there was no maaseh.
What?
Or maybe there was no maaseh.
Yeah, but here the maaseh was okay. You ate kosher.
But it was
maaseh. We'll see one second why. There's a reason why. For instance, let's go back to the guy who ordered the non-kosher steak, and they delivered it, they served it, he ate it on Sunday. Monday he went into the restaurant and he said, that was great yesterday, give me another one. They serve it and he eats it. On Tuesday, he goes back into the restaurant and he says, give me another one. And that, on Tuesday, the lightning bolt hits the waiter and he goes home without the steak. On Tuesday, he needs kapara as if he ate the steak. Why? Because on Sunday, if it hadn't happened, the first time that he did the sin, God says, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. that even had they delivered him the steak, had they served it, he would have changed his mind. Now, even though God knows everything that's going to be, when it comes to our free choice, he chooses to function as if he doesn't know. Otherwise, we'd have no free choice. So God can give you the benefit of the doubt. He says, I choose to function as if I don't know what's going to be. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. You would have changed your mind. But once you did the sin twice, we have a rule that since one person did a sin twice, it becomes to him like it's something okay to do. It loses its in his mind, it's not prohibited anymore. It becomes something that is by habit, becomes something you're conditioned to. And therefore, there's no reason to give him the benefit of the doubt that he wouldn't have done it the third time. Mamela, if somebody ordered a non-kosher steak, thinking it was a non-kosher steak, he ate it, but it was really kosher, there's no benefit of the doubt. What could you have done? You ate it. You thought it was not kosher. There's nothing to give you the benefit of the doubt. The same way that the third time in the first kind of situation, where in the end you didn't get the steak, you're going to be punished because there's no ways to give you a benefit of the doubt. The first time, if you ate it thinking it was treif, there's no benefit of the doubt there either. Now, this only applies between man and God. Why? Because there's two problems with a sin. One problem is that you actually committed the sin and you ate a poison. Non-kosher food is poison to your neshama. You poisoned your neshama. So for that you need to do tshuva and somehow get an antidote. You also rebelled against God. For that you need God to forgive you. So one thing is between you and God, forgiveness, and the other is between you and the sin. The sin needs to be, excised from your system. Okay, it has to be, it's a poison. So when you ate non-kosher food that you thought was not kosher, but it was kosher, there's nothing that affected your system. But you intended to rebel against God. And therefore, you need kapara for the rebellion. You don't need kapara for the food, because it didn't have any bad effect. You ate kosher. But you thought it was treif, you intended to rebel against God, you need kapara from God. Okay. But, let's say, I gave my friend what I thought was poison. Wanted to poison him. Turned out to be vitamins. So I didn't poison him, just the opposite. I helped him. Do I need to ask that person mechila? No. Because I didn't hurt him. So I'm not going to be judged for hurting somebody. And the fact that I intended to poison him, there's no prohibition, right? There's no iser to intend to poison somebody as long as you don't do anything. It's not like rebelling against God, where there's a specific prohibition to rebel against God. Here there's no specific prohibition to rebel against somebody else. That's why when the brothers came to Yosef and they asked him for forgiveness, what did Yosef tell them? You don't need any forgiveness. You intended to do bad to me, but God made it work out for the good. So you don't need to be forgiven. Now on the surface, Yosef was right. Because between man and man, if you intend to do something bad to somebody else, but you don't actually do it, then what'd you do? You rebelled against him? There's no issue of rebelling against another person, just like this. That's only between you and God. So in theory, Yosef was right, except he forgot one thing. It's prohibited to try to do something bad to somebody from God's standpoint. That's between you and God. Forget about between you and the other person. God doesn't want you to try to hurt somebody else. So in that respect, you need to ask God for forgiveness. You don't need to ask me forgiveness, Yosef should have said. But you need to ask God forgiveness because you attempted to do something that God didn't want you to do, to hurt me. And the attempt is also rebellion. Since he didn't tell them that, he told them they don't need to be forgiven. And therefore he didn't forgive them or instruct them to ask forgiveness from God. It was never completely atoned for, and therefore you needed the 10 Asar Ruge Malchus to Mechaper. It says, whenever Rabbi Akiva would come to this sentence in this week's Sedra, Isha Haferam Hashem Yislechla, that even though the husband nullified the vow, the woman needs Kapara, he would cry. Because he was one of the 10 martyrs that had to die to be Mechaper for Machiras Yosef. Had Yosef known this Pasuk, he would have forgiven them, or he would have directed them to ask forgiveness from God. Not tell them you don't need any forgiveness. And then it would have been forgiven. And since it wasn't, he had to be one of the 10 martyrs that died. Therefore, whenever he came to this pasuk, knowing Baruch HaKodesh, what was going to be, he cried. Or maybe he didn't know, but his mazel knew, and he had his feeling, right, even though he didn't know what it was all about, that there's something to cry about on this pasuk. Okay. Next. The next sedra, the parsha of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. Okay. So, a few things are very difficult. I have if you look at my Sefer, Outlooks and Insights, I see a nice shot on this, but I'll just give you the basis of it and something that's not in the book. The whole parsha is very difficult to understand. Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven come, and they ask for a share in Eretz Israel outside, on the east side of the Jordan, right, not to cross over and get their portion over there. And the reason is because it's pasture land and they have a lot of cattle, and this is great, great place for them to take. Moshe jumps on them right away. You mean you don't want to go and help fight, and you're cowards, and you're going to make everybody else be cowards, just like the Meraglim? Why did Moshe not judge them favorably? Give them the benefit of the doubt. All they said is, we want our portion here. They never said they're not going to go and fight with the rest of the people. Right? So the people said, no, that's not our intention. We meant we'll go and fight, we'll leave our families here or whatever, and then we'll go fight, and then we won't get it till we come back. We never meant to say we want to stay here and not join them in the fighting and conquering Eretz Yisrael. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu jump to conclusions right away and give them terrible mussar and call them terrible despots? They're continuing the sin of the spies. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Mitzvah, right? Dam lekaf schus. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu give them the benefit of the doubt? The answer, I think, is that this parsha, from this parsha we learn, v'yishem nekiyem me'ashem u'mi'Yisrael. A person has to be clean, not only in the eyes of God, but in the eyes of people. You can't do things that are suspicious, that look suspicious, because people will assume that you did something wrong. Now, even though a person has to give somebody else a benefit of the doubt, but everybody has their Torah. And I have to give you the benefit of the doubt that if I see you do something suspicious, that it's probably okay, under certain circumstances. But you have a Torah that you can't do things that are suspicious that would make me not give you the benefit of the doubt. I have my responsibility to give you the benefit of the doubt. You have responsibility not to put me in a position where I may not give you the benefit of the doubt. Don't do suspicious things, right? Don't walk into McDonald's, right, to get a soda when somebody looks, sees you going in there, think you're going to go getting a hamburger, right? Especially don't sit down at the table. Right, and take your lunch and eat it in McDonald's, right, even though it's kosher, people are going to think you're eating something trade. So I'm supposed to give you the benefit of the doubt, but you're not supposed to put me in a position where I have to give you the benefit of the doubt, and maybe I won't. That's called the Yishem Nekiyem Me'Hashem Yisrael. That's what the parish is. Moshe Rabbeinu said, I know that that's not what you mean, but that's what it looks like. And you have to take in consideration how other people are going to see it, for two reasons. One is that if people see you do something that is not 100% right, so they're going to either, one of three things. They're going to think that it's right to do, because you're a nice religious person. You wouldn't do it if it wasn't okay. And they're going to assume that you're eating McDonald's. McDonald's is probably okay to eat it, because this from person wouldn't do it if it wasn't okay. So they're going to come to eat in McDonald's, and you only went to get a soda. Or you took your lunch and ate it at one of their tables. Second possibility is they're going to think that you did something wrong and you ate treif. That's going to affect them also in a bad way. You know why? Because the more people that are around you that do wrong things, the less peer pressure there is for you to do the right things. So if they're going to judge you unfavorably, right, and think you did something wrong, it's going to be easier for them to do something wrong. And also, so you don't want to be machshel them either way. Either they're going to do something wrong thinking that it's okay to do because you did it, or they're going to know it's something wrong, but they say, you see, other people do things wrong, so what's not so terrible to do things wrong either? There's not going to be that peer pressure to hold them back. So therefore, a person has to be careful not to give people reason to suspect them of doing wrong, to do things in a way that you're clean, not only in God's eyes. God knows I'm not doing anything wrong. No, but people should know you're not doing anything wrong either. Don't do things that are suspicious. Do them in a way. Says that's why the Kohen, who counted the coins in the Lishka from the monies that were given for the sacrifices, couldn't go in with a beggar with pockets. That nobody should suspect that he put a few coins in the pockets. But he did have no pockets, no hem. So that way, it's clear that he wasn't doing anything wrong. There's no place to be suspicious. That's what we learn from this parsha. Okay, next. It says that B'nai Gad and B'nai Ruvain had a lot of money. They were rich people. And because of their wealth, they chose to live outside of Eretz Yisrael. Eivra Yardin has some holiness more than Chutz Laretz, right? But it's not the full Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, compared to Eretz Yisrael, it's Chutz Laretz. Compared to Chutz Laretz, it's Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, the Medrash says that because they chose to live outside of Eretz Yisrael because of their wealth, they went into Galus first. If they lived outside of Eretz Yisrael, what kind of Galus there was there? And the answer is that it was not Eretz Yisrael in relationship to Eretz Yisrael, but it wasn't Chutz Laretz in relation to Chutz Laretz, so they went into Galus to Chutz Laretz. They lost that level. Now, the Medrash comments on this that there are three presents that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives in the world, and if you have any one of them, you could have everything from that. One is wealth, one is strength, and one is wisdom. And whoever gets these presents could use it for in tremendously good ways. You could use your wealth, and with wealth you can have everything. With wisdom you can have everything. With strength you could have everything. When is that, says the Medrash? When it comes as a present from God. But if a person grabs it, then it's worthless. B'nai Gad and B'nai Ruvain didn't recognize that their wealth was a present from God. They thought they grabbed it. Now, you can't grab anything. God gives everybody what they get. So what does it mean when it's grabbed or it's a present? The answer is your perspective. You think you grabbed it. If you think you grabbed it, right, and you don't realize that it's a present by God and has to be used as such, then you'll misuse it and abuse it. If you realize that God gave you a present, then you'll use it in a way that's befitting a present that God gave you. So you use your wealth in a positive way, use your wisdom in a positive way, use your strength in a positive way. But if you think that you grabbed it, you can use it any way you want. It's mine. I got it. I can use it anyway. And then you won't feel the responsibility to use it properly. Then you're probably going to abuse it and distort it. Okay. There, in the beginning of Maaseh, there are listed 42 different stations that the Jewish people went from Mitzrayim till they came into Eretz Yisrael. And the Sfarim say the 42 represents the 42 letter name of God. There's a name of God with 42 letters. You're all familiar with it, even though you may not know it. You say it every week, at least once. Ona, Bekoach, Gedula, Shemincha, Tatir, Tzrura, right, has 42 words in it. And the first letters of those 42 words spell that 42 name of God. Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Ona, Bekoach, Gedulas, Yemincha, Tatir, Tzrura, Yud, Tav, Tzadik. So the question is it seven six-letter names? Seven six-letter combinations, or 14 three-letter combinations? Shaila. How to split up the letters to make it the name. But that's the name of God. Why the 42-letter name of God? So even though I'm not very proficient in the names of God and Kabbalah, but a very simple idea, I think. The number 42 is 6 times 7. 6 is direction, place. Up, down, 4 directions. Wave the lulav to 6 directions. That's 6. 6 is the perfection of place. Up, down, 4 directions. 7 is the perfection of time. right? 7 days of creation. So everything that you want to have a perfect unit of time is seven. 7 days of Avela, 7 days of Chasana, Sheva Brachas. Whenever you want to have a complete unit, 7 days of Yontif, complete unit of time, right? Matzah, Sukkah, 7 days. So seven represents the completion of time in this world. Six represents place. So the Jewish people had to spend a certain amount of time in the Midbar, and they had to be in a certain amount of places. So the name of God of 42 letters, which represents the perfection of time and place together, is what those 42 masos were. All the places they had to be, plus all the time they had to be, is represented by the seven and the six. I think that's a valid idea. It says that there's an issur of returning to Egypt. So the Urayim, one of the Rishonim, says that prohibition only applies if you return the way that you came. Okay, in other words, if we retrace those 42 stations backwards, then you're not allowed to return to Egypt like that. But if you go to Egypt some other way, you don't transgress that prohibition. Right? So we don't hold like that. I mean, halachically. But there is an opinion like that. The only problem is that in the Tochacha, in Kisavo, it says part of the curse, right, is that I'll send you back to Egypt in boats the way that I told you you're not allowed to go back. Meaning, it seems that going back to Egypt in boats transgresses the prohibition of returning to Egypt. Now, if you follow the 42 masos, there was never a time that they went by boats. That means you'd have to go a sea route, not a land route. It would seem from that pasuk against this Urayim, that it's when the Torah says, I'm going to send you back by boat, the way that I told you you're not allowed to return to Egypt, that you're not allowed to return to Egypt any way you go, not just to retrace these 42 masos. So I was thinking, no, there's no proof. There is the same way we came, going back by boat over the Red Sea. Except when we came, we didn't go through it by boat because it split. But if you want to retrace the steps, it's not going to split for you on the way back. You have to go over the Red Sea by boat. So therefore it's possible to go back the way the Rabban Hashem said not to go, according to the Urayim, meaning retracing backwards your steps in these 42 masos, and part of it you're going to have to do by boat, because the Red Sea is not going to split for you again, so you're going to have to get over it by boat. But that is exactly retracing the route. That could be what it means. It's interesting that when it mentions these 42 stations, it doesn't mention that we got the Torah at Har Sinai. It just mentions the place. It doesn't mention what happened there. Happenings are a different thing. We said we had to be in certain places, and we had to be there a certain time. So the seven and the six represent the place and the time. What exactly transpired in those places, and for how long it happened, that's a different story. But there was, aside from what happened there, aside from we got the Torah at Har Sinai, we had to be in that place. Right? Even if nothing happened. Could be that's what it says in the Haggadah. Ilu kervonu lefnei Har Sinai. If God would have brought us to Har Sinai and not given us the Torah, Dayenu, there would have been some benefit just being in that place. Even if nothing occurred there. So the Torah doesn't mention the occurrences, because now we're not talking about what we benefited by occurrences in the desert. We're talking about what we benefit by being in different places and for different amounts of time, and the total time in the desert. Time and place is significant in a person's life, even not associated with what happened in those places. Just being in the place is something significant. Okay. Okay, and the Pesedra ends with the Inyan of Arei Nikla, which we once spoke about in great detail last Elul. So I'm just going to mention the idea. Arei Nikla are for people who kill people unintentionally. Right? Who goes to Arei Nikla? Right? Somebody who doesn't appreciate life. Because if you appreciate life, how could you possibly be negligent with it and end up killing somebody if you appreciate how important life is? Now, why would a person not appreciate life? Because his attitude towards life, his perspective on life is the seconds between you're born and when you die, and the amount of pleasure you can have. So there's no intrinsic value to life, and once you're born, you start to die. So nobody's all that happy in this world, so how important could it be? But if you look at life from a Torah perspective, that life in this world is an opportunity to create eternity every second. You can do something that creates eternity by living in this world the proper way, and you create Olam Haba. Then every second in this world is eternally valuable. So from the first perspective of life, I take away a second, 10 seconds, a minute, a day, how much, right, how much importance is there? How much pleasure could the guy have had? Maybe he's going to die of a heart attack 2 minutes after I killed him by accident. How long was he going to live? Who knows? So there's no intrinsic value to what I took away from that person, because maybe it was only 1 second. And maybe he wouldn't have had such a happy life. But if I took away the option, the potential to create eternity, if I took away 1 second, I took away eternity from that person. If I made his life 1 second shorter, because in that second he could have created more Olam Haba. So therefore, a person who doesn't realize the importance of this world vis-a-vis the world to come, but he looks at this world as just a place to amass pleasure, and there's no intrinsic value to this world in any second, then he could come to be negligent with his own life or with other people's lives. So we send him to Ari Miklat. We take him out of his kvias. We put him in a temporary place to show him this world's only temporary. We put him together with the Levium, that he should see what a spiritual life is. And he goes out when the Kohen Gadol dies. Because you know when people really appreciate the Kohen Gadol? When he's no longer here. And they say Hespedim, and Art School writes books about him. Then they appreciate him. Till then, people don't appreciate great people till they're no longer here. Achrimos Kedoshim Emor. Right? So, at that point, the person now has gotten a refresher course in how important life really is. Now he can go back and hopefully be more careful with his own life and with other people's life also.